Hello, and welcome to episode 10 of Break the Cycle with your host, Joshua Smith. That's me, not Smee, like I said in episode 4 or something like that. I hope everyone's having a great Friday, man. It's almost Easter, you know, the day Jesus arose, and now we have some pencil neck pocket protector nerds at the CDC telling us that we're not allowed to shotgun White Claws with our grandma in the living room. So that sucks. But we're doing all right, man. We're doing all right. Let's start off with some sponsors as per the usual. Lorenzotti.coffee, of course, delicious Italian coffee delivered directly to your house. Bring the taste of Italy home, man. It's good stuff. We're ordering more right now. It's fantastic. And I'm not just saying that because they sponsor the show. It is actually very good coffee. TopLobster.com for all your wonderful graphic tees, including this amazing Tower Gang Tetris shirt here. If you're a fan of the Tower Gang, you should definitely be ordering the shirt. If you use BTC at checkout for Top Lobster or the coffee shop, you are going to get a 10% discount. Tower Gang's doing great things, man. They are out there fighting the Antichrist every single day, man. They're great people. And also, Anthem Planning. For all of your emergency crisis planning needs for your business, they're doing a wonderful job doing things that the government wish they could do better. AnthemPlanning.com. Definitely hit them up. Delaware residents, they're working their butts off, and their Mises Caucus. So you're supporting a good business that's doing good things in the Liberty Movement. All right. So now that we got all that stuff out of the way, we have a wonderful guest today, guys. I'm really stoked about this. If you watched his debate with Dave Smith on the utility of the Republican Party versus the Libertarian Party, as far as how they act in the Liberty Movement, then you already know him. He's a former Maine state senator, congressional candidate, policy advisor for Young Americans for Liberty, and all around nice, amazing, cool guy. So let's give a round of applause to Eric Brakey. How you doing, Senator Eric Brakey?
Hey, Joshua. It's a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for having me on today.
Yeah, of course, man. I'm stoked that you're here. I was really looking forward to this one. I was a little nervous, man. You're kind of getting famous in the Liberty Movement these days, man.
I don't know. I don't know anything about that. I'm just doing what I've always been doing, which is just trying to push for liberty the best place and the best way that I know how.
Sure, absolutely. Well, you know, you and I came from pretty similar backgrounds as far as how we got into the Liberty Movement. For me, it was the war thing. You know, I served on the USS Constellation during Operation Shock and Awe. And when I got out, I was just completely jaded on the military-industrial complex. And you know, it really hurt me to continue to be in the GOP. I was no longer a neocon. And prior to joining the military after 9/11, I was a neocon. I thought that we had to go to war to solve our issues. And then I found a gentleman by the name of Dr. Ron Paul in 2007, I guess. Funny enough story, I was actually sitting in a bar and they had the news on, you know, the TV, and I'm hearing this guy talking. I didn't know who he was prior to this. I grew up in the 80s, but I didn't watch the Robert Downey Show or any of that stuff. You know, I didn't know much about politics. I just kind of went with my gut on, you know, how I voted or whatever. Supported Bush, unfortunately, until he declared war while I was sitting in the middle of the Persian Gulf. But I worked on Ron Paul's campaign in 2008. You worked on his campaign in 2012. Do you remember, like, the feeling of the Ron Paul campaigns and how united the Liberty Front was? I mean, that was such a beautiful thing.
Oh yeah, you know, it's interesting. I in the last decade or so, there's only one thing I've seen the Liberty Movement. There's only one moment I can recall in recent history that the Liberty Movement has been united since the end of Ron Paul's 2012 campaign. And that was that recent moment when Ron Paul had that mini stroke
Sure.
during the Ron Paul Liberty Report. And it was like a moment where we were all kind of terrified together. All of the libertarian infighting ended for a moment, and we all just kind of were worried about Ron. And I think that really is just a testament to, you know, I mean, Ron was and continues to be the most uniting force in the libertarian movement, which is saying something because this is a movement. You know, anyone knows who's tried to organize in this movement, it's like herding cats. So there's something about Ron Paul. There's something about the way that he, delivers the message, the way he doesn't kind of judge people, the way he's welcoming to, you know, all different kind of takes, the way he doesn't even try to tell people what the right strategy is. He just says, "Go do liberty, figure it out yourself. There's a role for you." I think there's a reason that Ron, brought so many of us to this movement. And I will say, you know, I didn't get involved until 2010. I was a, neocon before that. You know, I was a pretty young guy. I was graduating college in 2010. But you know, you were kind of in the first wave, and I didn't get, I like to think of the 2008 campaign as the first wave, 2012 campaign as the second wave. We've had a couple waves of the Liberty Movement since, but you're a first wave guy. You helped pave the way for folks like me and everyone to come. So thank you for being a part of that before I was smart enough to realize that liberty was the way.
Well, you know, it took a war to push me there, man. You know what I mean? It's like, it's funny that the people that support the ideals of liberty the hardest always seem to be veterans. You know what I mean? It's funny how going to war can change your entire outlook on, you know, modern government and how they act with these, you know, the military industrial complex. And it's pretty wild, man. But Ron Paul, I mean, you know, talking about blowback and the Iraq wars and the Middle East wars, I mean, that really just changed my whole perspective on everything, not just, you know, not just the wars, I mean everything. And then because of Ron Paul, I found people like Murray Rothbard and F.A. Hayek and Milton Friedman, and you know, I started reading this literature, and that's a window that once you open, you can't close that window ever again. You know, it makes it really, really hard for you to look at especially the federal government, you know, and this push for central planning and these pushes for constant war and destabilization of the Middle East, and it just makes it hard to turn back. I mean, are you into philosophy at all? I've seen you quote some authors here and there, but who's some of your favorite guys that you've read and kind of cultivated your outlook on politics and philosophy?
In the Liberty Movement specifically, or broader philosophy?
Oh man, broader philosophy. Hey, look, how to influence people and make friends. You know, there's all kinds of great books out there that can, you know, and then
You
Immanuel
know,
Kant, and there's a lot of great philosophy. Anything that
yeah,
helps
I mean,
shape who you are, man, talk about it.
well, I actually, I think it's, something Murray Rothbard said. He said the first kind of libertarians in recorded human civilization were the Taoists,
Sure.
in Eastern philosophy. And I kind of find a lot of I've studied Taoism a bit over the last couple of years, and I've just kind of found that this is the most kind of libertarian kind of spiritual philosophy, and totally compatible with any kind of religious beliefs that individuals have. But Taoism kind of has increasingly had an influence on me. But inside the Liberty Movement, I mean, I read Rothbard. I've read, I remember when I was first getting into this, Ayn Rand had a big influence on
Sure.
me. But I think we all go through our Ayn Rand phase.
I never did, man. I never did.
Well, you're the exception that proves the rule then.
Yeah. It's funny because every time, you know, especially the leftists, they're like, oh, why don't you go jack off to Ayn Rand or whatever? I'm like, I never even liked Ayn Rand, man. I don't know. You know,
Well, I don't think the leftists ever read Ayn Rand either. I think Ayn Rand is kind of like Hans Hermann Hoppe, where everyone's
sure.
got a strong opinion, but nobody's actually read
Yeah.
read the works.
Yeah, and Hoppe makes some great points, and I've been attacked for I've been attacked on both sides of that because I hadn't read enough Hoppe, so I was like, I don't really know enough about Hoppe to have an opinion. I got attacked by one side for that. Then when I started reading more of Hoppe, and I was like, hey, you know, Hoppe makes some really good points. I started getting attacked by the other side for that, and I'm going, okay, you know what? I'm done. I'm just gonna do whatever I want to do. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and truth be told, I'm still at that phase where I haven't read much Hoppe, so I'm Hoppe neutral until I actually do some reading and understand what his arguments actually are.
Sure.
On their own terms.
As you should be. I mean, really, you know, you should. Yeah. But how do you feel about Scott Horton, though? That's the really important one these days.
I love Scott Horton. You know, I remember when I was running for Congress, I was a bit of a Scott Horton fanboy, and I reached out to Scott Horton. I said, hey, you know, I'm writing my announcement speech for my campaign for Congress. I want to be really hard hitting on foreign policy because I felt like we were getting to a point where, one, it's always been, you know, while I've been in the liberty movement, that's been my most important issue is the foreign policy. And I've been genuinely excited to see that I think that we are in the GOP to some degree. We're turning that ship from where we were under the George W. Bush neoconservative kind of, you know, monolithic take on kind of the neoconservative foreign policy to where people are much more open-minded in the GOP now about, you know, maybe we don't need to be in these wars. Maybe this is wasting a lot of money. Maybe this isn't a good use of, you know, the lives of our soldiers. And so I wanted, you know, Scott's kind of take on it. And I had a great call with Scott. It was a great call because it lasted for 3 hours and I got maybe a few sentences in the whole time. But that's Scott Horton. He's an encyclopedia.
Yeah, I have Scott coming on the show on Tuesday, and I'm like, look, I'm just gonna turn the mic off and let you go, man. It's your show. You know what I mean? I'm gonna pull out. I got enough already. His new book up here on the bookshelf, and I'm trying to get through it. I've been watching the. He was nice enough to send me the ebook version so that I could read it while I'm at work on my phone and stuff. So I'm trying to get through it before he comes on the show because I want to be able to talk with him about it. And as a veteran who actually served in a Middle Eastern war, he knows, I mean, scores and scores and scores more than I ever could hope to. So, yeah, I totally get that, man. But it is fun watching conservatives and Republicans, you know, that have been a part of this neocon age start getting red-pilled on the military-industrial complex and wars and the police, too. You know what I mean? Especially recently.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you look at, you know, frankly, I think you look at the history of Republicanism as an idea, I guess, small R Republicanism and to some degree, the Republican Party in a general sense and the neoconservative movement kind of dominating the message on foreign policy is really an aberration in the context of history. I mean, you look at like Robert Taft, who was Mr. Republican, you know, in his time, he was the best U.S. senator we've ever had until Rand Paul came along. And he was, you know, strong, you know, opposed to kind of, you know, intervening in these foreign wars. You look at the America First Coalition, which included many, you know, very big figures in American society who were, you know, opposed to kind of Woodrow Wilson's push to get us into World War One. You know, skepticism of war has historically been a Republican position, and it's been the progressive movement pushing us into wars. So anyway, I hope that we are rounding the corner and the Republican Party is coming back to its roots.
Yeah, I'd love to see it. We're going to get into this a little more. Obviously, I sit on the Libertarian National Committee. I'm a libertarian through and through. I believe that the party can be a useful vehicle. Some people call that white-pilled. I like to call myself a little more gray-pilled. I'm skeptical, but I'm optimistic, you know. But how, you know, you talk about the America First coalition, right? America First under the Trump GOP has taken what seems to be a kind of a different turn as far as that American First. While there are some great liberty Republicans like yourself and Massey and Amash was great on a lot of things and Rand Paul was good on a lot of things. Obviously, he's always going to be against wars, which I appreciate. How has it been trying to work with the Trump GOP? I mean, is it hard as a Liberty Republican for you?
I mean, you know, it's you can look at the glass as half full or half empty. I mean, I've chosen to look at the glass as half full. I mean, I guess for me, you know, and I recognize some of the younger people in the movement may not have this context, but I know that you do. You know, for those of us who grew up under the neoconservative movement being in a position of really absolute dominance in the GOP, it's on foreign policy, it was hard to imagine we would ever be at a point where mainstream conservatives were questioning the wisdom of these wars in the Middle East. And yet here we are. Now, of course, people aren't as, you know, far along perhaps as you and I are, but I try to be both, you know, generous and patient with people because, you know, I remember being a young, you know, when I was in high school, you know, the foreign policy was the hardest thing for me to let go on my journey to libertarianism because I grew up under the Bush administration. Geez, the first candidate I ever like got involved and volunteered for was George W. Bush in his reelection in 2004. I was making phone calls in Ohio to help him get reelected, and I was excited to be involved. I was in high school, so I was a little dumb. And I believed, you know, all the Fox News line and everything Bill O'Reilly told us about the wars.
I was at war, by the way, at that time.
Well, I'm sorry that I cheerleaded, you know, for you to be put sure. into that. But, you know, I think for myself and for so many Americans on the right at that time, you know, support for those wars became almost a part of your political DNA. It became a part of your identity. And so for at least that's how it certainly was for me. And so to admit that you were wrong on something of such significance, of something of such great consequence, is a very hard thing for most people to do. Sometimes you really got to just kind of try to crack the door open for people. People can't, you know, swallow the whole red pill all at once.
Right.
Sometimes you got to say, well, you know, maybe it made sense to go over into an Afghanistan at that point. But now Osama bin Laden is dead and Al-Qaeda is destroyed. And why are we still over there? So you're not telling people, hey, you were wrong back then. Saying, well, maybe you're leaving the room. Maybe you were right back then. But does this really make sense today? You know, I think that's how you kind of crack the door open. Sure. At least that's how people had to. It was a process for me to get beyond that. And I think it's a process for a lot of folks. But yeah. I'm glad that people are going through that process, even if it's you know, slower than it was for us.
Sure. And it was, I mean, the wars red-pilled a lot of people at the end, for sure. So what's your plan moving forward as far as, you know, Liberty Republican? How are you going to try and bring more Liberty Republicans to the GOP?
Yeah, well, you know, I'll say, look, my goal overall is to make Liberty win. It's not necessarily to make Liberty win in the Republican Party. I just see the Republican Party as the most effective vehicle we have available to us. So, you know, I do think that sometimes in the movement, we get caught in this game of like, you know, being loyal. You know, I see it on the LP side and the GOP side where people can get caught up too much in, you know, loyalty to the party, whichever party that is. But we need to strip away and we need to, the party is just a vehicle and we should use the vehicle that's most effective to getting the Liberty Movement to where we want to go. So I'm working with Young Americans for Liberty because I think that Young Americans for Liberty has the most effective strategy in place today to advance the Liberty Movement, which is, you know, we have this huge advantage of our activist base in the Liberty Movement, and Young Americans for Liberty has been cultivating this on college campuses across the country. We've got 500 chapters on college campuses across America now. And across the last two election cycles, we've developed a new strategy called Operation Win at the Door, where we mobilize our student activists to go knock doors in races for state legislature, where we've identified, vetted, and sometimes recruited candidates who are Ron Paul style principled liberty folks. And over the last two cycles, we've now got 179 Ron Paul style liberty legislators elected across the country. 178 of them were elected as Republicans. One of them was elected as a libertarian in Wyoming. He's part of our Hazlitt coalition, we call it. They're doing amazing things. I'm helping to, you know, coach and mentor some of the newer legislators. But I'll tell you, when I got elected to the state Senate in 2014, this wasn't really a strategy people were pursuing in the movement. We were all still focused on the federal level. You had so many people running for Congress and U.S. Senate, and we won a few races here and there, but mostly we lost. Even if the goal is Congress and U.S. Senate, over 50% of those who serve in Congress started in their state legislatures. Sure. So if we can build the bench of state legislators, that's put us in a better position when opportunities open up in the future. But of course, also, if the goal is to try to kind of take on the Washington machine, sometimes the direct assault isn't the right approach. Sometimes when you're going against a very fortified enemy, you've got to look at the indirect path. And you've got to look at maybe surrounding those fortifications and cutting off their supply lines. And I think that's what we can do in the state capitals. We can go to the state capitals. We can work on nullification efforts like defend the guard, cutting off the supply of our young men and women being sent off into these unconstitutional, never-ending wars. We can look at ways to, you know, nullify gun control policies, nullify other assaults on our freedoms, even nullify maybe there are certain tax policies we can nullify there too. So
have you worked have you worked with Michael Bolton and the 10th Amendment Center on any of that stuff?
Not directly, though I will say one of my bigger accomplishments when I was in the Maine Senate was passing right to try legislation, which nullified the FDA on, you know, terminally ill patients being able to access non-FDA approved medications. It's federal law now, but at the time it wasn't. I sponsored that. We became the first state in New England to pass it. And that was just an idea I got by listening to Michael Bolden on the Tom Woods Show.
He's amazing, so, man. He's going to be a guest on my show in a couple weeks too, man. And he's become like a really good friend to me. I'm from California. He lives in LA. So he goes to a bunch of libertarian events and stuff. You know, he stays pretty nonpartisan because he'll work with anybody on nullification but man, he is just a wonderful dude. You should definitely, I guarantee you he'd have a phone call with you, man. And just talk about you talk about anything with you for as long as you wanted to talk about it.
Well, I'm a fan of his. And I think I don't remember if I worked with him directly or I worked with someone at the 10th Amendment Center, I believe a few years back when I sponsored their Fourth Amendment Protection Act in Maine. That one didn't pass, but it was a cool nullification idea. Anyway, I'm a big fan of 10th Amendment Center and Michael Bolden.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So as a Liberty Republican in the state legislature in Maine, what kind of stuff were you able to accomplish? I know in the legislature, you have to build relationships. I know that that's an important thing to do. You have to build relationships within your own party. You have to build relationships within the Democratic Party. If we had any libertarians there, you'd have to build some relationships with them as well. Talk to me about like what you were able to accomplish there and, you know, what kind of relationships and how those relationships were fortified to help get you guys there.
Yeah. Well, you know, the conventional wisdom is in a legislative body, you know, it's all about building relationships with your colleagues. And I think that there's value in that, but I do think that a lot of legislators can get sucked into that a little bit too much. They want to become friends with their fellow legislators, and that leads to kind of getting co-opted by the establishment a little bit and getting into this whole, hey, vote for my bill, I'll vote for your bill. And this kind of, I always believe we should, read every bill for ourselves and decide on the merit of the policy, not our relationships with our colleagues. But that said, I was more effective than most legislators in Maine in getting some serious things passed. Some of the big policies I mentioned, right to try, I sponsored and passed constitutional carry legislation. Maine became the sixth state in the country to pass that. We're up to 19 now. Iowa, the governor just signed into law there.
Thank God.
In Texas, it just passed out of the committee. I was just testifying there on that. So we may be getting some more constitutional carry states in the near future. But constitutional carry, right to try, passed some major welfare reform legislation, did a big expansion of our medical cannabis system along free market principles. I actually think Maine's got the best medical cannabis program in the country. And I also helped a bunch of sixth graders legalize hedgehogs. That was a when sixth graders come asking for more freedom, I think that that's something that should be rewarded. So we legalized hedgehogs for them. But you know, just as proud of the policy victories where, you know, actually changed things, I'm also just as proud as the times when, you know, I'd be standing alone and, you know, against everyone on corporate welfare policies or for civil liberties where just the rest of the legislature doesn't get it. But I would say what made me effective there was not so much the relationships I made, though that did help a little bit. I'm generally a nice guy. My rule is in politics, be nice to people when it costs you nothing.
Sure.
Eventually you're going to have to stand your ground and be a dick. So you might as well be nice when it doesn't cost you anything. But the reason that I was effective wasn't necessarily so much because of my individual efforts by myself, but it was because I was able to reach out to networks of people who cared about these issues across the state. And rather than building relationships with the politicians, I built relationships with their constituents. And then I mobilized their constituents to put pressure on them to tell them to vote for liberty on constitutional carry, on welfare reform, on all these issues, or they'd get voted out of office. And ultimately, I think that, you know, in politics, there's, you know, there's two models for kind of how to kind of lobby a legislature. You can have access-based lobbying, which is what we typically think of when, you know, the lobbyists take politicians out to dinner. It's about building relationships. Or you can have a more confrontational style, which is you threaten their reelections by mobilizing their constituents. And I think ultimately with our goals, where we're trying to get liberty back from the system that is not so predisposed towards liberty, that's really the only real path we have available to us. It's not always pleasant. It's not always nice, but they're politicians, and if you want a friend in politics, get a dog.
Hi, kids. Do you like violence?
Are you sick to death of pussyfooting around the truth while being constantly fed lies by news and big tech tyrants? If so, then come join me, Dan Smotz, on The System Is Down, where we get weird, have fun, and dig into all the dangerous taboo topics like conspiracies, politics, religion, culture, current events, and everything your family just prays you don't bring up around the Thanksgiving dinner table. And I know that reality is scary to some people, so if you're easily offended, just ignore this and go back to making cat memes or whatever. But if you're ready to change the world for the better, come join me on The System Is Down at tsidpod.com or wherever you get podcasts. That's tsidpod.com, because the system is down and truth is taking over.
It's a dirty business. I mean, I ran for intra-party office twice, and it got so ugly from my own party members that I was just...
the politics of party politics are the worst kind of politics.
Yeah. Yeah, it gets really ugly, man. I mean, they went after my family and my relationships, and I mean, it was just dirty, dirty, dirty game. And that's on the Libertarian Party. I mean, we're talking a small pond here, right? The less than 20,000 members at the time, $1.7 million a year budget, and I'm going, what are you guys fighting so hard for? You know,
it reminds me. You know, I remember when we kind of took over the main GOP in 2012 on the Ron Paul campaign, and as a favor to a friend who was the state director of the Young Republicans, he asked me if I would start a county chapter of the Young Republicans. And I said, sure, we've got all these new young Ron Paul people who'd love to be involved. But then the establishment showed up, and it was kind of a question. Well, someone asked me, are they going to run someone against you for chairman of this this Young Republicans chapter? It's like, I don't know. Like, why would they do that? That'd be pretty stupid. This organization doesn't exist yet. There's no power here. And yeah, they did. It was a tie vote. And I just said, why am I fighting for this? Yeah. Like, you guys can have it. If this is what you really want, like, this organization didn't exist until 5 seconds ago. Like, go and take it. It's yours. Within three meetings, they disbanded as an organization. It was just about trying to spitefully stop people from coming into the party who actually wanted to grow the party.
Sure.
But I think that can be, you know, party politics is the worst, because it's sometimes dealing with a lot of people who maybe will never actually wield true political power, but will just be standing. Hopefully, if they're doing their job well, will be standing next to people. Right. And so this is anyway, it's yeah, it, it,
I like a lot better when we're fighting over things that actually make a difference.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that's how it should be. You know, we should be, if we're going to have an argument, it should be about the way forward and how we're going to change things, not about, you know, this person did this and this, you know, I agree fully. So you ran for, Congress.
I did.
Right. Any plans to run for public office again in the future?
I don't know. I haven't ruled anything out. So I ran for U.S. Senate in 2018. I was the Republican nominee in Maine. I ran for Congress in 2020 in the Republican primary. Was a strong front runner in the race. Things looked good until COVID hit. The primary was delayed a month and a half. We had to stretch our budget a month and a half longer than we thought. And then the neocons came in with $500,000 at the last 3 weeks that they dumped on me, calling me a never Trumper because of comments I made in, you know, defending Rand in the primary. So yeah, that didn't work out as we'd hoped. You know, truth be told, I don't see myself running for federal office, at least not in the immediate future. I think I've done that twice, and I'm really beginning to think more and more that the state capitals are where the fight is. So I'm focusing my efforts on the state capitals. To be totally honest, I've thought about running again for my old state Senate seat in Maine that I held for two terms, but I haven't made any decisions there. And ultimately, my bigger focus is just making sure this we can keep working this state capital strategy, and whatever I can do to be a force multiplier there and help this new wave of liberty legislators that are kind of making their way, you know, getting their sea legs and really starting to make a difference. I tell you, you know, people ask all the time, you know, who's the next Ron Paul going to be? And, you know, I think the next Ron Paul is going to be, you know, one of these liberty legislators we're electing to the state capitals. Watch what they do. And there's going to be some real heroes emerging from this in the future.
Well, we need 100 Ron Pauls is what we need. You know, not who's the next one. We need 100 next Ron Pauls. You know.
Well, I got some good news. I got a 187 for you. So,
okay, I'm gonna go through all their platforms and make sure first, though. Okay. So you know a little bit about the Mises Caucus. I know you disagreed obviously with Dave in your debate on the utility of the Libertarian Party and versus the GOP. Are you familiar with the Mises Caucus and what they've been doing and how far they've come in the last 3.5 years?
Oh yeah. And I consider myself very philosophically aligned with the Mises Caucus. Philosophically, I think people are right on. Strategically, I think the better play is to, you know, try to focus instead of taking over the LP to take over the GOP and the GOP civil war that's just starting in the post-Trump era. But I have total respect for the philosophical integrity of folks, you know, in the Mises Caucus.
Sure. So hypothetically, okay, we get through, I don't know, 2024. All right, the Mises Caucus is firing on all cylinders. They've continued to quadruple their growth. They've taken over the Libertarian Party. The Libertarian Party is now the fastest growing party in the country. You think it'd ever be a useful vehicle if that's the direction it starts taking?
I think it's unlikely. On a long enough timeline, if you can, the biggest obstacle is the rules of the system. Ron Paul talked about it being a rigged game. The rules are written by the two major parties to make it a two-party game. It's not just the ballot access laws, but it's also just the whole kind of first past the post plurality based voting system that makes the vast majority of voters say, well, I've got to vote for the lesser of two evils because otherwise I'm throwing my vote away. I could vote for the third party candidate who most aligns with me, but that guy doesn't have a chance of winning, or at least that's what most people believe. And so I think the biggest obstacle the LP has is plurality.
Libertarians.
Voting. Well, you know, there's always going to be like party infighting. In the GOP, there's party infighting. In the Democrat Party, there's party infighting. There's always going to be that. True. People are always eating their own. But the rules of the game are not built for a third party. So look, there are states where some of these things are changing. I know the Libertarian Party was part of the effort to kind of push for ranked choice voting in Maine, right, which is kind of partially passed. There's some changes in Alaska and some other states. I don't know how these things are going to work out in the long run, but I guess theoretically, if movements like these were to spread across the country, it could break down the two-party paradigm, and maybe a third party like the LP becomes more viable as far as winning elections under a system like that. But I think that something like that is change like that happens very slow, and I think that's a long ways off. Until such a time as that, I think if we want to try to make real political change, policy change, and win elections in the here and now, the best path we have is to winning primaries in the GOP.
Sure. And I made that clear before we started this interview, and I've talked to lots of Liberty Republicans. I'll work with Liberty Republicans. Obviously, I'm, as a sitting national board member for the Libertarian Party, I can't go out and endorse the Liberty Republican over the Libertarian candidate. It would be bad form for me as a national leader for the party. But where there is no Libertarian running, or there's already a sitting Liberty Republican, I think that there's some that have done some great things. And but I'd also like to flip you all to Libertarian. I mean, that's, you know, at the end of the day, that's where I want everybody. So I think the Mises-Cocks doing great work. I think here in the next 4 years, they're gonna start really surprising people. But you know, we talked a little bit about this before the show too, with the Frontier Project and the Libertarian Party, where, you know, we have very limited resources as a national political party. We're trying to play this asymmetrical warfare game with financial juggernauts across the country. And it's very hard to do for a party that's so small, that has, you know, we could run 1,000 candidates, but we can't support 1,000 candidates. So what the Frontier Project now has done is started focusing on areas like Wyoming, where we have started winning or almost winning, and actually flipping one of their state legislators. We have two there now, because one of them flipped after the election to Libertarian. So
in Wyoming?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I knew about Marshall Burt in Wyoming.
Marshall Warren, right.
Okay. Yeah. I know Young Americans for Liberty deployed and helped with Marshall's campaign. We are very excited. You know, first Libertarian elected to a state legislature in like a quarter century, I think.
Sure. Yeah, I think it had been a long time. I think the last one was in Alaska, too. So, and it, you know, yeah, at least 25, 30 years. I think it was, I want to say maybe the 80s, even like early 80s. It's a long time ago. So
I'm trying to remember the story of that guy in Alaska. If I remember right, he won. He didn't finish the term because he ran for president or something.
Libertarians, man. You never know what a libertarian's going to do. You know. We do some crazy things.
I think Marshall's
definitely
sticking around, though.
Yeah. You know, and they've had a couple of really strong candidates in Wyoming, and it's because we took the limited resources we had, chipped off a big chunk, and sent a bunch of people there to work on those campaigns, as you should if you're a political party and you want to win elections. You know, and I think I heard your debate with Dave. You actually, you know, you read the dictionary definition of a political party, and how, you know, it's to you know, win elections. There's no philosophical ideology thing there, right? In the Libertarian Party, we're a little different. We have a bylaw that actually states that we have a multifaceted goal. One is to get people elected. It's a political party. We'd obviously want to get people elected. The other is that we want to educate people on the ideals of liberty. So there is a little bit of a think tank aspect there. I don't know if that's harmed the party. You know, sometimes people go into our platform and start just fighting with everybody on each individual point. And I've always said, let the candidates make their own damn platform. You know what I mean?
You should see GOP platform debates.
Oh man, I can imagine.
Yeah. No, I think these kinds of things happen. We feel the infighting always that happens in our own sphere. But we always think, geez, the other parties have their stuff together way more than us. But truth be that infighting is.
Well, I try to explain this to people too. I'm like, listen, you only see the libertarian infighting so much because there's so little of us, right? Like, you know, every libertarian across the country online. I mean, you just know them all. You know what I mean? You see them all the time in these, you know, delegates groups and stuff like that. The Republican Party is so big that you don't see all the county groups fighting. You know what I mean? We when I lived in Southern Washington, this is actually when I got involved with the party again in 2016. The Clark County Republican Party, like the chair was funneling funds into his private bank account or something like that. And I always use this as an excuse because there's corrupt people all over the country. It doesn't matter what political party you're in, but nobody heard about that. Nobody heard about that shit. If that happened in one of the county parties in the Libertarian Party, every libertarian in the country would know about it because it's just a small pond and everybody's a big fish.
Yeah. Well, thankfully there isn't enough money in the Libertarian Party for
that too. You know, there's some campaigns that have raised some pretty good money, and we did, you know, this last election cycle was good for us. I mean, we had Ricky Harrington Jr. in Arkansas, who ran against Tom Cotton, got 30-something% of the vote for a U.S. Senate race as a Libertarian.
Yeah, there was no Democrat in that race, right?
Right. And the funny thing was PBS. Okay, so Ricky Harrington is this very calm, soft-spoken black preacher from Arkansas, right? Nice as pie. Probably one of the nicest guys you'll ever see in politics. Very honest, very down to earth. And PBS from Arkansas offered a debate to Tom Cotton versus Ricky Harrington because there was no Democrat. And that's like, you know, that's an opportunity as a libertarian. You have to jump on that because we don't get invited to the debates. And so he, and of course,
Tom Cotton wouldn't do it.
He declined. So what did they do?
Yeah.
PBS let Ricky Harrington get up there and talk for an hour with the moderators by himself. It was one of the most beautiful things I ever seen. And Tom Cotton's not well liked, right? Even in Arkansas where he's at. And so he, you know, Ricky Harrington, a libertarian.
The worst of the worst.
I mean, he's definitely up there. I'm not a big fan of Mitch McConnell either, but that's neither here nor there. So he got an hour to address his constituency with libertarian policy, you know, and he got like 35.5% of the vote. Definitely the most we've ever gotten for a U.S. Senate candidate. So it was pretty cool. And then we won some state legislature seats. We got a lot more local people elected. So we're getting there, Eric. I'm telling you, a couple more years, you're gonna have that L next to your name, man.
But I'll tell you, you know, but the places where the LP wins is when one of the two major parties doesn't have a candidate in the race. Yep. So like Marshall Burt won, like, because he was able to, it was a Democrat in the race. The Republicans never ran anyone in that race. And so he was able to not just have the LP faction, but he was able to rally the Republicans around him too and say, why would we just let this Democrat have the seat? And so, and this is the barrier. The barrier is like, when it's a two party race and the LP is the one of the two parties that positions the LP to do great, but when there's a third party, people are just programmed.
Sure.
You know, they see the R or the D and that's where they instinctively gravitate towards. It's so hard to overcome that unless we can get to a place where we move beyond the first past the post system, and we're starting to see that. And maybe long term that could spell some real electoral success for the LP. But geez, it's difficult in the short run.
It's hard. It's been hard. I mean, the party's been around 50 something years and it's always been a fight. But, you know, we do have many years where we get 50 state ballot access. We won't talk about Tennessee. It's a problem. And a couple other states here and there. But, you know, they fought really hard for what they are. You know, they're like the little engine that could. They keep going on a broken leg, you know. So I'm proud of them. Let's talk about some tyranny.
We should get some of those really energetic, like awesome liberty activists to come and come to a party where they can make a difference.
Okay. I see hey, you can't be recruiting my libertarians, man. We don't got a lot of them, okay? let's talk about some tyranny in this country, man. This idea of COVID passports. Obviously, it's something you're against, right?
Oh yeah, it seems to me like the latest iteration on this idea of that they've been pushing for decades of this kind of this national ID card, but this time it comes with all of our medical information attached to it. you know, I remember, you know, Ronald Reagan took one look at this proposal. You know, it was the National ID card proposal was put in front of him. And he said, "That's the mark of the beast. We're not having that." Yeah, but it's an idea that that never dies. It's a dream for central planners to be able to, you know, basically track and monitor the entire American population.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, obviously, I don't agree with him on everything, but people like DeSantis, you think he's doing the right thing by signing an executive order, basically banning any idea of a COVID passport in Florida?
You know, if I were to look at the exact policy, I feel like maybe, you know, I could critique it here or there. I could say, like, you know, is this overall, I'd say yes, you know, in broad strokes, yes. You know, I think that certainly pushing back against anything kind of coming from the federal government, you know, it's always hard when we're talking about private property rights and private businesses and what they want to allow. But of course, these days, like so many big companies, big corporations are, their leashes are held through government contracts and government regulations. They aren't really independent actors. You know, I think Ron Paul said recently that, you know, big corporations have become the favored vehicle of big government to do the things the Constitution doesn't allow them to do.
Sure.
And there's a lot of it's increasingly becoming evident that that's true. So in a general sense, yes. If I were to look at the exact executive order, I can't promise there's nothing I wouldn't critique in it.
Well, is there ever an executive order that has something you wouldn't critique in it? I mean, let's be honest here, you know, they pack this shit with so much pork all the time. You know, it's always look here, we're going to do this. I mean, it's constant. And they do that in these economic stimulus bills as well. I mean, what a farce that has been. You know, we're going to pay you $1,400 to look the other way while we send money all around the world. You know,
You
know, so if you ever do get in Congress, we have your word that you will take over Rand Paul's spot in Congress or the Senate as the official House filibusterer, right?
I don't think you can filibuster in the House. I can talk a long time and I'm good on my feet, so I think those are the only two things that are required. But I don't see anything like that happening, at least not in the near future.
But can you read a 5,000 page bill overnight though?
You know, I don't know that anyone can. So I think it's easy to come to the right answer and vote no.
Sure. Sure. Just Dr. Know It Up, man. We learn from the best, right?
Yeah. Ron definitely blazed a trail and left an example for all of us.
Sure. Sure. So, you know, we just spent a whole year in tyrannical hell, you know, obviously the COVID passports is just it's an idea, but we actually dealt with this shit for a year. How did Maine do, man? I mean, did you guys shut it all down? Did it get all dicey and,
Maine's been pretty awful, which is a real shame because, you know, for the last decade, we actually had a halfway decent governor. Now, he wasn't a libertarian, but he never would have done any of this stuff. But we have one of the most tyrannical governors in the country. Her name is Janet Mills. Oof. I remember when she was attorney general, she was the worst kind of Democrat. She's the kind of Democrat who, you know, some Democrats you find some common ground with, like, hey, you know, like all the ACLU Democrats out there. Hey, we can agree that like government shouldn't be spying on people. And, you know, maybe we, you know, on drug, you know, drug kind of freedom and all of that. But she was the worst kind of Democrat. She was big government on economic policy, big government on personal liberty. She's just as for government controlling everything. And she became the Democrat nominee. She won, and she's been awful. She has kind of had some of the most draconian lockdown policies anywhere you would find in the country. You know, Maine is a state that relies very heavily on the tourism industry. It's called vacation land, and the tourism industry has just been destroyed. It is hard for me to imagine how long it will take for Maine to recover, except for the fact that because of Joe Biden in the White House now and just kind of handing out trillions of dollars across the country to to the states that to Democrat run states, basically stealing from the states that didn't have these draconian policies. That, you know, we're getting a whole bunch of federal money coming into Maine. But of course, that's problematic because, well, for so many reasons. But one of the reasons is it makes our state more dependent on Washington, D.C. Sure. We become literally a welfare state. And when you are when a state or a person is stuck on the welfare system, when you're dependent, you lose the ability to make decisions for yourself, and everything is dictated. And I think that's happening across America. All the states are becoming so dependent on federal funds. We're losing our piece by piece. We're losing our sovereignty.
Sure, sure. So you're, you know, obviously a big proponent of everybody flooding the GOP with liberty advocates. We know that a lot of people are just not going to do that. You know what I mean? Like, it's a lot of libertarians, especially from the party, but there's a lot of libertarians out there that are small L libertarians that won't join the political parties at all. You know, that's always going to be an issue. It's not a problem. I don't think it's a problem. I think they do good work in their own ways. They have podcasts, they do certain things, but would you also advocate that they start doing, counter economic stuff, you know, evading taxes. I mean, you know, the kind of agorist stuff that starves the government. I mean, if they're not going to join in with the political system, do you think that it's a good idea to start doing these counter things to the government to resist? I mean,
yeah. I mean, I think that one of the best things people can do is to nullify the Federal Reserve by buying Bitcoin.
Yes.
To buy into, I mean, like, you know, inflation it's a tax on savings, but only a tax on savings in dollars. So why keep your savings in dollars? I've been trying to move all my savings out of dollars, or at least just have on hand what I need for the short run, because look at all these trillions of dollars being printed. We can see the way things are going. I have tremendous respect. You know, I have tremendous respect for anyone who is getting out from behind the keyboard, getting off the sofa, and doing something to promote liberty. So I have many friends who are kind of agorists, voluntarists, who don't engage in the political system. You know, I would hope that if there was a real, like a Ron Paul, you know, running, that they would, like, you know, engage enough to, you know, vote for that person in a primary, like we all did in 2012 and 2008. But yeah, no, I respect whatever path people take, as long as people are fighting for liberty.
Sure, sure, sure. Well, hey, man, this has been a great talk. We're definitely getting close to the end. Are you familiar with Nicholas Sarwark?
A little bit. And you know what? Truth be told, I know Nick. I know there's been a ton of drama, and Nick has picked a lot of fights with people that I really like and admire. Like Tom Woods and Dave Smith and others. I was surprised, actually. I met Nick Sarwark at I think maybe it was Freedom Fest or something a few years back. And I was surprised, considering like his online persona and how much of a dick he's been to people on Twitter. I was surprised to have a conversation with him that actually was, you know, productive, and he seemed like a reasonable person. And I don't know what it is. Like, people just people get behind the keyboard and they just,
he wears a good mask in public. Trust me.
Well, you know, I don't know what it is. Social media, I swear to God, just brings out the worst in people. So, but yeah, no, I know Nick Sarwark, and I wish he would stop picking fights with good people. But other than that, I hope he and his family are doing great, and he's, lives sure. a wonderful life.
Well, this is great, because he's, you know, he's one of those people that wants to submit to the will of anybody who's ever held an office. And so now you're hearing it from a former state senator. Nick, stop being mean to people. We're done with it. We're done with it. How about Tower Gang? Have you heard of Tower Gang yet?
No, what's Tower Gang?
Oh, man, I can't explain it to you, man.
Is that related to your shirt?
Yeah, it's a group of people that have kind of went to war with the blue check marks online. So it's been a lot of fun to watch.
Oh, wow. I am a blue check mark online. So yeah, I gotta watch out.
Not all blue checks. Hashtag not all. No, that's not true. Cause I told them that I was going to try to get a blue check mark just to troll people. And they're like, well, you know what's going to happen. We're going to come after you. And I'm like one of the early adopters of Tower Gang, man. So,
you know how I got my blue check mark? It's a funny story. I had verification on Facebook or something, and I thought I had it on Twitter, Apparently I didn't have it on Twitter. I just made a mistake. But I logged on one day and I saw that I didn't have a blue check mark on Twitter. And I thought, did they get rid of my blue check mark? And so I just started a Twitter campaign. Hey, Twitter, why'd you remove my blue check mark? What happened? And like libertarians across the spectrum, like just got all upset and like just messaging Twitter, you know, and before I knew it, I had a blue check mark. So
sure.
Raise a fuss and you might get one.
Well, here's the thing with libertarians, man. We know that there's so many shitbags out there with blue checks that we need to have some good people with check blue checks too. You know, you got to balance out the good and evil, Eric, you know, but shoot,
yeah,
man,
yeah.
I really appreciate you coming on, dude. I think this is a great talk. I'm a big fan of yours. I hope you do a lot more work in the liberty movement forever, whether that be at the state level or the federal level. I think you're going to be a bright shining star. We won't call you the next Ron Paul yet, but, you know, there's room for it, man. Where can people follow you at?
You can follow me on Twitter at Senator Brakey. You can follow me. You can like me on Facebook, Eric Brakey over there. And, you can. Anyway, just keep fighting for liberty, and I'm sure we'll bump into each other somewhere along the way.
Absolutely, sir. Hey, thank you so much again for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure's all mine, Joshua.
All right, guys, that was former State Senator Eric Brakey. He's a great guy, man. It's very hard to find somebody that is that nice in the liberty movement. I enjoy talking with him. I enjoy watching him. His debate with Dave Smith was probably one of the most jovial debates I've ever seen. Usually we want to kill each other. So definitely go follow him, man. He's a great guy. He's a good voice for liberty. He's solid on principle. Even if he's a GOP guy, he's still very solid on principle. Don't forget about him, man. But yeah, good show, guys. Definitely make sure you check out LaurenZotti.coffee again. BTC at checkout is going to get you a 10% discount. Same with TopLobster.com, where you can get this wonderful Tower Gang shirt if you support the Tower Gang and their very godly work against the Antichrist. Check them out. Anthem Planning, anthemplanning.com for all your emergency crisis and planning needs for your business. They do good work. Mises Caucus people out of Delaware, executive producers of the show now. I will actually have one of the owners on the show, not this coming Wednesday, but the following Wednesday. As far as the schedule goes, guys, we changed it up a little bit. We were going to have Scott Horton on Friday, then Spike Cohen, Michael Bolden, Phil Labonte, but Scott has now been changed to Tuesday, so we'll have Scott Horton on Tuesday, and then on Wednesday, we're going to have the legend, Neocon Remover. He takes no shit. It's going to be interesting. We're going to have a lot of fun together. He'll probably drop some surprise stuff, and then we're going to have maybe a very special surprise guest next Friday. You're definitely going to want to check it out if that's the case. Make sure you smash that subscribe button on YouTube. I'm trying to grift that ad revenue into becoming a stay-at-home dad and doing daily content. Check us out on Patreon, man. We got some good levels. The chat on Discord is filling up quickly. That's patreon.com/breakthecyclejs. Really cool swag over there. You can also become an executive producer if you'd like to throw those mini smackers at me. But other than that, man, I will see you guys on Tuesday for the always great Scott Horton. And until then, don't forget to break the cycle.
Due to legal reasons, I just have to explain. The lyrics of my last song may seem to contain a violent call to action in the verse and refrain. But I just spent it in Minecraft. The helicopter part was in reference to GTA 5 and the things you do. So any violence you commit, I am not an excuse, because I just spent it in Minecraft. Well, Chipper is my friend and he's constantly cold. Accusations of incitement getting totally old. Make your own choices, yeah, you have control, because I just spent it in Minecraft. Obviously I would never advocate force, unless it's due process and a trial, of course. And if you're convicted, we will make you a corpse in Minecraft, just in Minecraft. You're nothing, I mean, you know it. No product, dinners, gets it close from COVID.